Yes, I will.
That's a good idea.
Yes. Well, now, the family, in fact, derives from Warwickshire. It goes back to the time of Sir William Dugdale, who was Garter King of Arms to Charles II. He was really regarded as the founder of the family. And then his descendants carried on in Warwickshire by making one or two rather advantageous marriages and finding coal deposits in the part of the country where they were. They tended to prosper and you know, became richer as the time went on, I think. And by the Victorian period, by the sort of mid-Victorian period, they were definitely established as quite a county family, with the head of the family was usually high sheriff and director of the bank and all this kind of thing.
So they were very well-to-do by that time.
They were, and they made an ornamental lake in the grounds. This was at Merivale, near Atherstone, Warwickshire. And in fact, they had they'd married the Stratfords, because my name's Stratford Dugdale. And the Stratford heiress, Penelope Stratford, in the sort of early 1800s. And that's how they got the Merivale estate, which adjoined their own property. And they pulled down, or more or less pulled down, an Elizabethan house and rebuilt it in the style of the Victorian Gothic, so that the outside of Merivale House now is all Victorian Gothic, which some people say was a great pity. And we have accounts that they furnished it, you know, with all the latest things. They,
like, I see,
typical,
yeah.
Victorians, they didn't really seem to want to
quite
keep
ruthless.
Antique. Oh yes, they wanted to furnish it with the mid-Victorian stuff. And my grandfather, who of course was Mrs. Cruikshank's father, he was the sixth son of seven. And they also had three or four sisters as well. They were very big, typical big Victorian family. And the eldest son, of course, was left the property and had to spend his life looking after the estate. The younger sons were generally put into the services, or one of them became a lawyer and a member of Parliament. And the youngest of all, who was named Sidney, who remained a bachelor all his life, spent his life as the estate agent of Merivale. So they were all very loyal, I think, to the place. And they all had, I'm being told this on good authority, the best, when they were young men, the eldest son was given a very good room for himself, and the second son was given a slightly smaller room, and the third son smaller than that, until they got right down to the sixth and seventh son, who had practically little cubby holes for their rooms. And this was all done as tremendous sort of a hierarchy, you know. Anyway, I have been told that. And my father, my grandfather, who was named Edward Stratford Dugdale, he was sent to Eton, but then he was taken away from Eton very quickly by his father, who decided he was going to the Navy. And so he put him into the Navy, like they did in those days, without the son really having any say in the matter. But fortunately for him, he obviously enjoyed the Navy, and he did really quite well. He ended up as a commander, and he could have gone on to higher rank, but he did retire then, I think largely under the influence of his wife. He married when he was about in the early 30s, in the late 1870s.
Yes.
And his wife was, I think, a very dominant woman. She was the daughter of a barrister. I think their surname was Richards. I think it was. I don't know very much about them, except that she was, I think, rather dominated him on the whole. And I think that many of my aunt's suffragette qualities definitely derived from their mother's side of the family, rather from their father's side of the family, who were extremely conventional people, my father's side of the family. But you see, my grandmother was herself interested in the suffragette movement and actively encouraged her daughters to take part in it. I think she was too old to be a really militant, very active herself, but she egged them on, she encouraged them. And she was a very dominant person. I only remember her when she was an invalid, rather sad, really. She had to be wheeled about in a bath chair, and she had terrible arthritis. And as a result, she was rather a terrifying figure for a small boy of 5 or 6 years of age. I remember absolutely quaking when I saw her bath chair appear in the park, and I begged to be allowed to go away from her, but my nurse said, no, you must go and meet your grandmother. I won't allow you to avoid her, you know, this sort of thing. But course, I was very, very small then. And they lived, at one time, they lived in Aberdeen because my grandfather, he had an appointment at Aberdeen in the Navy, while he was still in the Navy. Apparently there were two rather important appointments. One was at Portsmouth and one was Aberdeen. And anyway, he was appointed to Aberdeen. And then as a sort of summer residence, a Boyne, which is in the Dee Valley, you may know where it is,
yes.
It was just becoming a residential place at this time. And so they bought Gordon Lodge, which had only been built a few years before they bought it by somebody who'd been out in India. And the sort of little portico conservatory-like thing at the side of the house, I believe, was designed by him because it was like an Indian veranda, something of that sort. And the family became very, very attached to the house, and indeed to Boyne itself. And it is, of course, a lovely place. But
I haven't actually been there, but
generation of the family are not so attached to Boyne. And now that Gordon Lodge has passed to the next generation, nobody of the present generation wants to live there. But my father's generation were all of them immensely fond of Boyne, and this goes for Mrs. Cruikshank as well, who in fact she bought the shore at Boyne later on.
That's her little private
house. Yes,
it is.
Yes. Gordon Lodge itself was really quite a period piece until very recently, because it still had the original furnishings that were there in the 1890s, including many of the wedding presents of my grandparents. And really, the dining room looked like a piece from the 1880s. I mean, it had the big, enormous great table and the big sideboard and leather-backed chairs, and it was all in the style of that day, and with sort of stained glass windows, you know, in the dining room. And, of course, upstairs they had the old marble-headed washstands and all this sort of thing. And they did very little, as a matter of fact, surprisingly little, one might say, to modernize Gordon Lodge. They did add a bathroom, admittedly. But they did very little else to modernize it. They let out part of it because the house divided itself into two parts. And what had originally been a sort of servants' quarters and servants' hall at the back, that was let out to tenants. Because you could shut it off. There was a door that shut it off, so you could separate the two sides of the house. And so it was a pretty big house. It really had about, I don't know quite how many, about 8 or 9 bedrooms at least, something like that. And so it really was quite big. It wasn't so wide in front, but it went back a very long way, you know. It went deep. It was deep rather than wide. And in the house, of course, were quite a lot of portraits of the family, including a very good one of my grandmother. Must have been done, I think, about 1890. And there it was. And
so it's really a family centre.
Very
family
much
house.
A family centre, mm-hmm. And was in fact a family centre right up until, until it was really until my aunt, Mrs. Cunningham, who died at the end of 1973. It was her house, it was left her by her parents. And then my father was living there then because his wife, my stepmother, he married again after my mother's death, who died when I was quite a baby. And then he lived there with my Aunt Daisy, you see. And after she died, he continued to live there. And then he died only a few months after she died. He died in April 74, and she died in November 73. And after he died, no member of the family lived there. But it remained in the possession of the family, of course, until it was sold only this year.
I see, it has been sold.
It's now only just been sold. About a couple of months ago it's been sold to somebody known to the family, to friends of the family.
I see.
Anyway, yes. It has been sold now.
And the shore has been sold as well, has it?
No, Almora's still got the shore. She hasn't decided what to do about the shore.
Mm.
And my father, too, was very attached to Gordon Lodge, very attached to it. And it had quite a nice kitchen garden as well, and a lawn in front, and vegetables and fruit and this kind of thing.
Wasn't it a bit cut off? Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, you're a bit stuck up there, aren't you? I mean, were they not a London family? I mean, didn't they feel the need to have a base in London, really, do you think?
Well, they originally did have a base in London. Mm. You see, after my grandfather retired from the Navy, I was telling you that they had this house at a boy, and that is true, but they also had a house in London, in Sussex Gardens, but they gave that up, oh, a very long time ago. Mm. I couldn't quite put a date to it, but I think it would have been certainly in the 1920s or very early 30s. You see, my grandparents both died within a fairly short time of one another, round about the year 1931. And I'm sure that after their death, the London house was disposed of, but I can't really give you any details of that.
Mm.
I never remember the London house. I don't think they used it very much latterly. And then, really...
So they've come down for the season, I suppose. Would they all come down
They've really come up for Boyne, for the Boyne season, that. They come for July, August and September, when all the gaieties took place at Boyne, the Boyne games and all the Highland dances and parties and things, which don't really begin till about August, you know.
Were they actually a very Scottish family?
Not at all. They had no Scottish ancestry whatsoever. But you see, that didn't matter to Boyne. A lot of English people came to live at Boyne, which has sometimes been called as a Scottish Weybridge, because it is in fact a place that a lot of English people took villas in. Do you see?
I see. Yes. And so they sort of absorb Scots culture.
Absolutely.
And things. As a sort of recreation.
That's right. Yes. Oh, they weren't really Scotch at all.
I see.
Though I have some old photographs of my father wearing a kilt as a young man. But he never wore a kilt latterly. I've never seen him in a kilt. But, you know, before the First World War, I'm talking of as long ago as that, he did wear a kilt then.
Presumably they were very well-known figures in the village.
Well, they did become well-known, you see, because they were residents a long time, particularly Mrs. Harrison Broadley, who was the most socially minded of the family and the one who was the most thrusting in that way and who got to know all the local people and enjoyed the social activities. Mrs. Harrison Broadley was the leader of the family in that respect, you see. Mm. And she often was loaned Gordon Lodge. She never owned, she was never the owner of Gordon Lodge, because that was Mrs. Cunningham's, you see.
I see, yes.
You see, in the true suffragette spirit, my grandparents, and I think I really mean my grandmother in this, instead of leaving most of their money to their eldest, to their only son, who was my father, like most Victorian families probably would have done, they favoured the daughters, and they thought that the daughters must have at least equal amount to their son. So in fact, my father inherited comparatively little from his parents, because it was divided up between him and the four daughters, you see.
That's remarkable.
And the daughter who'd looked after her parents and had not married, well, she did marry, but too late to have children, was a sort of compensation, left Gordon Lodge for hers, you see.
I see, yes.
That was Mrs. Cunningham.
Yes.
And so she made it her permanent home for the rest of her life.
Well, this is an invaluable background. I never would have known any of this.
Didn't tell more, tell you?
She told me a bit
she
of it.
She could have
not,
told you.
You see, if I may say so, you're very... your grandfather, you see, interests me.
Yes. Tell me, what do you want to know about him?
I mean, he was retired, presumably, all the time you knew him.
Oh, absolutely. I only knew him when he was about 80. He was born in 1845. Mm. And I only remember him... I couldn't remember anything much before about 1924, 25, when I was about 6 years of age. 6 or 7 years of age. And so he was a very old man when I remember him, and he was very, you know, very senile. He was very rather shaky and uncertain of his walking, you know, and he had to be looked after. He was very senile when I...
What's the sort of family tradition about him? I mean, was he a sort of cipher, really, by comparison with his wife? I mean, did he...
Well, the family were very fond of him. In fact, they were fond of both of their parents. The children were all very fond of their parents. They never said anything against them. And he was always known as Daddy. And she was always known as Mother. Not as Mummy, but as Mother. I got this from the photographs. My father always captions his mother as Mother, but his father as Daddy. And in his diary, my father kept a diary, which I have, but he didn't start to keep it till about 1947. But he kept it till he died in 1974, and I've got most of that. And he nearly always notes his father's birthday, which was in March. Daddy's birthday, he'll write, time and time again. But he never puts his mother's birthday, funnily enough.
But they were happily married.
As far as I know, they were.
And on the whole, your grandmother occupies a stronger position generally than most women.
She persuaded him to retire from the Navy. I think it was due to her influence, I believe it was, that he retired from the Navy while he was a commander. He could, as I say, probably have got higher rank.
Yes.
But she wanted him to retire because, of course, it's, I suppose a sailor's away such a lot from his family.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Yes.
But did she bring money into the whole concern herself? Was she herself well endowed?
I think she came from quite a rich background, but she had several sisters, you know.
I
don't think she brought something, but I wouldn't say an awful lot.
No, I see.
My grandfather, I beg your pardon, didn't have much except his pay and his pension. He had 100 a year from the Merivale estate, which wasn't very much. But that's all, plus his pay and pension. Of course, that was fairly good in those days, a naval officer's pension probably went further than it would now. I think my grandmother had some money, yes, but she wasn't what you call a rich heiress or anything like that.
Yes, I really asked you that just to know whether her position in the family was reinforced by money, you see, and independence. I mean,
I wouldn't have thought particularly, no. I think it was her strong personality and the fact that she obviously did hold radical views. And, of course, her daughters, Mrs. Cruikshank and Mrs. Duval, held radical views.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about politics. Presumably your grandfather, was he conservative?
Well, he would have been, but as I say, he was so old when I remember him. I'm sure he'd have voted conservative, absolutely sure he would.
Whereas his wife, you think, would have voted liberal at that time?
Probably, yes. I would expect her to have done, yes.
Yes. But anyway, the daughters then get this sort of radicalism from their mother.
I think undoubtedly. But it was much strongest in Mrs. Cruikshank and Mrs. Duval, the two elder daughters. The two younger ones were more socially inclined than politically motivated, I think.
Yes. Shall we move on to the daughters?
Yes, of course.
I mean, who would you like to discuss first? I mean, I'm equally interested in both, really.
Well, I think Mrs. Cruikshank, I knew her the best. The first time I ever saw her was at her marriage, as a matter of fact, to Fletcher Cruikshank, who was in the Indian Civil Service. He was a very nice man. He was a quiet man. Again, I think she dominated him, rather as my grandmother had dominated my grandfather. He was a very superior type of man. He'd been to Rugby School and Magdalen College, Oxford, as a scholar or demi of Magdalen. He'd done very well at rugby, both scholastically and at games. He played cricket and rugby football. I believe he played for the Harlequins at one time. And he passed brilliantly into the Indian Civil Service, which in those days was very difficult to pass into. You had to take an extremely stiff examination, and he crammed for it after he left Oxford. And he did pass into it. He had a family background of the Indian Civil Service. His father had also been in it, and this may have perhaps pointed his way there, I should think.
Yes.
He was a silent man, very given to reading learned works. He always said he never liked to read any book written by a woman. He was far from being a feminist, I would say. He enjoyed philosophical books and philosophical discussion. Unfortunately, his health broke down in India, or he might have risen to higher position. I can't tell you his exact rank, whether he was a district commissioner or what it was. He did quite well, and he served in the First World War in the Mesopotamia campaign as a colonel, I think he was.
Didn't
of course, this was all before he met my aunt.
Yes, didn't they meet going to some sort of secure place?
I wouldn't know quite. Almora would know that.
I think they met in the train or something.
Did they? Well, it's possible.
I think Mrs. Cruikshank was going with her mother to the south of France, and there was this rather attentive young man who looked after their baggage and things.
Yes.
And they just got to know him in the south of France,
yes.
And that it all went on from there. I think that's right.
I see. Well, it's quite likely that is so.
Mm.
Well, then, as I say, I remember their wedding when I was very small. And then they went off to India, and of course, I didn't see her for quite a long time, because they were in India, and of course I can only tell you indirectly about her Indian experiences, which she wrote about, to some extent. Almora, again, could tell you what she wrote about her Indian experiences. I know she did write about them.
Oh, she did, yes. Yes, yes.
You know, you can get that from Almora,
yes,
if you don't know it,
yes,
already.
Yes.
But she was a great admirer of the Indians, and she spoke with great enthusiasm about her time in India. She loved it. Of course, she was a VIP, to some extent. By that I mean that all the sort of local people, he had to go round on a sort of tour as a magistrate, from village to village, and he was feted and treated with tremendous deference
people
wherever he went. All that sort
exactly
of thing, and they were, you know, gifts of fruit were given to them, and they were carried about on a litter and made much of, and they camped, and they had a wonderful, luxurious tent which was pitched by the bearers, and all this sort of old-style Indian paraphernalia which went on in the 1920s and so on. I think he returned round about 1931 or two on health grounds. He was a great sportsman too. He enjoyed riding and polo and pig sticking and all this sort of thing. He was a very versatile because he was a horseman and an athlete and an athletic man, and yet at the same time a very intellectual man who enjoyed, you know, reading philosophical books and historical works and he enjoyed reading books like Lives of Abraham Lincoln and all this sort of thing.
Whereas his wife not so?
Well, his wife, she was, yes, she enjoyed reading. I'm not sure that she'd have enjoyed quite the same books as her husband. I picture him reading history and philosophy. It's difficult to know what. She, I think, would have enjoyed books about mysticism and about Indian culture and legends and about Eastern religions.
She's more romantic sort of type.
Yes.
More
she was a very religious woman. Although she had politically radical views, she never held them in any sort of aggressive, unpleasant sort of way that some people do. You know, she was very sort of civilized about her radical views, put it mildly. And she was very religious. Whether she was what you call an Orthodox Christian, I'm not absolutely sure, but perhaps she was, but she certainly believed in the afterlife and was very religious. And
I forgot to ask you, if I may interrupt you at that point, I forgot to ask you about the religion of the family generally. They're all Anglican, are they?
They were all Anglican and very much against Roman Catholics. They were all strongly anti-Catholic. They thought that it would be a disaster to marry a Roman Catholic or anything like that. They were very strongly non-Catholic. But I wouldn't say any of them are great churchgoers. None of them were particularly interested in the church in that way. None of them were great pals with the vicar or anything of that sort. They never became, you know.
I see. And they're not Presbyterian either.
Oh, no.
Yes,
they were Anglican, yes. Though I believe I'm not right in saying that Mrs. Duval is buried in a boy in the Scottish Kirk. I believe she took up with the Scottish Kirk.
Oh, did she?
But you better get that from her daughters. I'm not quite certain about that. Yes. But I think she did join the Scottish Kirk, and I think she's buried in the grounds of the Scottish Kirk in Aboyne. Because Aboyne has three, it's very full of churches. It's got the Episcopalian, which is equivalent to the Anglican, of course, which we went to. Then it's got the Scottish Kirk, of course, and it's got quite a flourishing Roman Catholic as well.
Has it really?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
It has.
Of course, it's a leisure centre, I suppose.
Yes,
that's why.
Yes. But Mrs. Cruikshank, as I say, was a religious woman. She believed very much in the afterlife. She was very interested in mysticism and anything of a spiritual nature. I don't think she was a spiritualist, not that I have any reason.
Was she a theosophist, and did she believe in theosophy?
Possibly. She was a great friend of Lord and Lady Pethick Lawrence.
Oh, yes.
Weren't they concerned with something like
that?
Yes,
they were interested in that too, yes.
And also, her other great friend, who wasn't a relation, was Cecil King.
Oh.
Was he the Daily Mirror, was it?
Well, Thompson.
Yes, Cecil King, she was a great friend of him.
Was she really, yes.
And of the Pethick Lawrences.
Yes, that's interesting.
Yes.
Maybe Cecil King might talk about her. I mean, he's still alive.
He ought to know, Miss. I'm sure he would.
Yes.
I'm sure he could talk about her.
Yes.
Lord Pethick Lawrence dead, of course.
Yes, oh yes.
He could have
yes.
talked about her too.
Yes, well, of course, I'd love to talk to him,
yes.
if any I could.
Well, then, what I've come to next is, I think she came to see me once at my private school. Well, then I chiefly remember her before the last war, when she took the Gatehouse at Merivale, for she knew my cousin, who's dead now. He became Sir William Dugdale, first baronet. He's known in the family as Frank, because his name was Francis. And Frank Dugdale, he was always known as. And his wife was Margaret. She was a very nice person. And I got to know them then, because my Joan, you see, and Fletcher, that's Mr. and Mrs. Cruikshank, they leased the gatehouse, which was a house on the Merivale estate, which had been used by the estate agent at one time. Quite a nice house it was. And they leased that house for several years before the last war. And that was when Almora was of school age, I suppose.
That's when they came back from India, I suppose.
That's right. And they'd come back from India looking for somewhere to live.
Yes.
And I am 4.5 years older than Almora. And I was just leaving, I was at Eton my last year, and I was going to Cambridge. And the period I'm concerned with is my roughly 1935 to 1939, which was my last year at school and my 3 years at Cambridge. Mm. And I used to go and stay with them in the holidays, which meant in the Christmas holidays, and I think sometimes in the Easter holidays as well. And it's then that I really got to know my cousins who lived at the big house at Merivale. And that was very interesting because my cousin, who's, as I say, is dead now, he lived to be over 90. He was very interested in historical subjects and in the history of that part of England and the Danish invasions, all this sort of thing. He knew
a
lot about
it. There's a Dugdale Society, isn't there?
There is, and he was a moving spirit of it, in commemoration of Sir William Dugdale.
Mm. Mm.
And, of course, I liked his wife, Margaret Dugdale, very much. She unfortunately died shortly after her husband. She was very much younger than he was. At that time, she was only about 40, whereas he was... he must have been, let me see, he was born 1872, so he must have been getting on to 70 then, in the late 60s anyway. But he was a remarkably active man. You wouldn't know he was so old.
So how were the Mrs. Cruikshank's family sort of living then? I mean, they were just,
Almora was their only child.
The only one, yes.
They never had any other children.
Yeah.
So they were just living, the parents with Almora, in this house, and a couple of servants.
They were retired.
Oh, yes, exactly. And, of course, now what, I will tell you this, I think it's relevant. As you know, my aunt had radical views, politically radical views. And socially radical views, rather. And my cousin, Frank Dugdale, my baronet, of course, had very, very true blue views, ultra-conservative views, or anything like that. And there was an occasion, I was told this, I wasn't there at the time, I don't know whether Almora told you this or not, but I believe it's absolutely true, when some boys, village boys they were, raided the apple orchard in the grounds, not of Merivale itself, but of the gatehouse. In other words, they stole apples from the orchard of the gatehouse. And this was undisputed they'd done this. Now, my cousin Frank, we'll call him, wanted my Joan and Fletcher, I'll call them, to prosecute these boys because he said it was stealing and that these boys had been taught a lesson. And he wanted them to make a prosecution. It was up to them to prosecute as the apples had been taken from the gatehouse orchard, you see. But my aunt, supported by Fletcher too, they both agreed on this, because Fletcher too had fairly liberal views, you know, on social matters. They were absolutely adamant that they would not prosecute the boys. And in the upshot, they won the battle and they didn't. They had quite a row with my cousin about it. And anyway, what he did do, my cousin, he had the appointment of the local vicar was in his pocket, as you can imagine. And he got the local vicar to preach a sermon against theft that Sunday in the local church. He did manage to do that. But still, that indicates perhaps something of the relationship between the Cruikshanks on the one hand and the Dugdales at Merivale on the other. But by and large, their relations were good. And Mrs. Cruikshank was very fond of Margaret. She liked her very much. She was a very nice person. And I used to be taken up there to lunch sometimes. It was quite an event to go to lunch at Merivale before the war. It was really kept up in full style. They had uniformed, liveried footmen who handed round the dishes in the dining room, you know, with brass buttons and liveries. And they had wonderful silver dating back from Charles II's day. The dessert was brought in, you know, wonderful plates with silver knives. And it was marvellous, all that. I wish I could tell you more details about it. I can't. And then you saw an enormous ham, you know, on the sideboard in the dining room. The dining room table was a vast table. In fact, when I went to his funeral, to my cousin's funeral, I counted that it actually sat 34 people sat down to lunch. I counted them, 17 up each side. It was as big as that. And that was an oblong table, of course, in the dining room. But at any rate, we had our meals, I say, in this big dining room. And what I do remember is that my aunt, and indeed Fletcher Cruikshank himself, were the slowest eaters in the world. My aunt was incredibly slow at eating. She always was. If I took her out to dinner, which I enjoyed doing, we were the last people in the dining room left. It was a little bit embarrassing that she was quite so slow.
Was it out of principle or health or something?
It was unconscious. It wasn't out of principle. I don't think it was out of health, although she may have believed it.
Fads, didn't she? I mean, she was quite keen on, interested in diet and things.
Well, yes, she was to some extent, but I don't know why she ate so slowly, but she did. And Fletcher, too, ate very slowly. And as fate would have it, the cousins, Margaret and Frank, ate incredibly quickly. They were the quickest eaters in the world. And what happened was that Margaret was sitting at one end of the table as the hostess, and Fletcher, as the chief male guest, was seated next to her. And I remember one occasion the footman handed round the dishes, beginning with Margaret, who helped herself and then started eating. And he didn't come round to Fletcher till everybody else had been served. And so Fletcher, it wasn't his fault, but he had to start last. And of course, before he'd even started to eat, Margaret had virtually finished because she was so quick. And she always drank a cup of coffee in one gulp. When coffee was served after lunch, she just gulped it down in one draught. And that was that.
What happened actually in the war?
Well, I used to visit them in the war, the Merivale people, I mean. Of course, this is nothing directly to do with Mrs. Cruikshank, but I used to go and see them in the war. I was in the Royal Army Pay Corps myself, and I was only a private soldier. And I remained a private soldier during the whole of my service, 5.5 years. And I remember on one occasion I was asked for lunch. And one had to wear a uniform in those days, and I was able to get a bus from Leicester on a Sunday. And I used to go to Hinckley, and I changed there, and I'd go on to Atherston. And then I'd walk from the bus stop up to the gate of their ground. They had a huge estate, you see. And, of course, they had various men about the place, sort of gamekeepers. And I remember on one occasion I was walking up, I'd been asked to lunch, and I started walking up the drive, and a furious gamekeeper rushed at me, seeing a soldier, you see, walking, asked me what on earth I was doing, you know, trespassing a mere soldier, you see, in the grounds. And of course then I told him I'd been invited to lunch, and he let me go up. And then I do remember that they had the most wonderful food. This was in the middle of the war. They still grew their own melons in a hothouse, which I thought was rather good. And they made their own ice cream. And I remember we had, delicious it was, melon and ice cream. And this was in the middle of the war, about 1942 or 3 it would have been. And my cousin, Frank, had a carnation in his buttonhole every day from his greenery, hothouse, which he still kept up in the war. He still wore his carnation in his buttonhole every day in the war. And we had this wonderful food, as I say.
So it really carried on.
Well, they had a very reduced staff. And I once spent the night there, and I remember we used the servants' hall as our dining room because of the staff were reduced. I don't know quite what staff they had.
What about Mrs. Cruikshank during the war then? She was up in Avoyne.
Mrs. Cruikshank in the war, well, they left the gatehouse in 39 before the war, I think. They left the gatehouse. And they took a flat for a short time in Porchester Gardens, which is W2, just the other side of the park from here.
Yes, I know.
And I remember going to visit them there sometimes. This was the very early days of the war. Well, then I was called up myself. I wasn't called up, as I had a rather low medical category due to my eyesight. That's why I was in the Royal Army Pay Corps. And I was called up in January 1941. And I rather lost track of Mrs. Cruikshank, of course, then, because I had to just go where the army sent me.
Yes.
And I was sent to Leicester, and then I was sent to Leeds, and I was sent over to the Middle East in Cairo for a time, till I was demobilized finally in 1946, you see. So I think she went up to Scotland. She probably went up to a Boyne for a bit, I should think. I know Mrs. Harrison Broadley was up to Boyne during the war.
Mm. So best I place think, to be, I'm certainly
yes,
not.
Yes, and Almora met her husband, you see, in Scotland. Mm. He was in a Scottish regiment, and they married during the war. Almora married her husband during the war. Did you meet Almora's husband?
No, I didn't. No,
oh,
I
Colin,
didn't
he's a nice man, Colin Murdoch. Mm. And they married during the war, and Almora joined the Land Army.
That's right.
Yes, they were in Scotland, that's quite true. Mm. They were.
I see. You presumably saw a bit of Mrs. Cruikshank late in her later life, did you? I mean,
well, I
what
used
was her
to
old
see
age
her.
Like, really?
Well, yes, I did. She had a tremendous zest for life. She loved life. And that is a characteristic of all my father's generation of his family. They didn't have an easy life, any of them. They had all sorts of difficulties to contend with. They were never all that well off. They had enough, but they were never had a tremendous lot of money to play about with, if you know what I mean. Mm. And they did have, as everybody I suppose has, but they certainly had their share of ups and downs, of minor and major troubles, as everybody does. And they all had this tremendous zest for life, my father included, and Mrs. Cruikshank, of course. Mm. And they were really, you know, invincible. They always seemed to ride above everything. Whatever happened to them, they seemed to ride above it. And I do think this must have been very much a characteristic of the family, because I don't think other people I've observed have it quite that same extent. But they really did, and they were very, therefore, optimistic, I would say, a very optimistic family. And really, I think, although, like everybody else, I suppose they did have their idiosyncrasies, they were nevertheless a very sane, well-balanced, sensible family. They never took up any silly sort of fads or fantasies or anything like that. They never went too far with anything. You know, they never suddenly got a craze for anything and spent all their money on it.
Do you feel, I mean, looking back on that generation, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you think they had a strong sort of sense of social obligation or social duty or anything like that? I mean, by comparison
what,
to
the
people?
Less fortunate people,
yes.
Do you mean? Well, I don't know. I suppose the fact that they joined the suffrage movement might suggest that they had. They weren't particularly given to good works in the Victorian sense of the word.
No, I see.
They weren't particularly given to good works. They didn't particularly, you know, take an interest in charities and that sort of thing.
So the woman suffrage thing isn't the first of many causes. It's just an incident that arises
yes.
out of family circumstances.
I suppose so, yes. Mm. I suppose it would be. Mm. Yes, I think it would be.
Although she does take up the Indians later when it wasn't really fashionable to do that, didn't she? I mean, you know, mixing in Indian native society and that sort of thing.
You mean when she was in India?
Yes, yes.
Yes, well, as I say, I can't tell you much directly about her Indian experiences. I'm sure she had a much more liberal view of Indians than most European women, most
yes.
Mem Sahibs. Because,
yes.
of course, she was a Mem Sahib.
Yes.
Whether she liked it or not, she was a Mem Sahib. But I'm sure she was a very liberal-minded Mem Sahib compared
yes.
to most of them.
Oh, surely, yes.
Yes. yes.
What about looks, Mr. Dugdale? I mean,
yes.
What did she look like? Mrs.
You've seen pictures of her, have you?
I have,
she
yes.
She had, it's difficult to describe. She had dark hair which turned grey. She wasn't very tall. None of them were very... My father was tall, but the others, the daughters, were not very tall. She had a reddish complexion, as I remember her. She laughed. She had a slightly protruding mouth, very slightly. She would laugh very easily, I think. She had a very living sort of eyes. I think her eyes were very alive. She had a very, I think, endearing personality and a very infectious personality and enthusiastic personality. And she, of course, she was a tremendous conversationalist.
Was she?
On the whole, she liked talking rather than listening, but she would listen. But she did prefer talking to listening. And she was a wonderful conversationalist. She was very good at a party or anything like that to keep things going. And, of course, other members of the family were the same in that way, but I would say Mrs. Cruikshank was very good at that.
But when you say she liked talking, what sort of things did she like?
Oh, well, the things that interested her. At one time, of course, she was very keen to talk about India. At another time, she might talk about political matters or...
Or women, perhaps.
Indeed, yes.
Mm.
Or about all sorts of things that might, you know, crop up in the paper.
Mm. She read the paper, did she?
Really? Yes. I think so, yes.
Mm.
And, of course, any book she might have been reading, she would want to talk about. Mm.
That's most interesting.
She didn't like, in talking of Indians, she had a tremendous bias against the Muslims.
Did she?
She admired the Hindus, but she did not like the Pakistanis, she did not like Mr. Jinnah. She liked Nehru, but not Jinnah.
Mm.
She was a Hindu, a pro-Hindu, and very much anti-Muslim, anti-Pakistan.
I see. Was she a person who enjoyed listening to other people's views, or did you feel free to say what you thought in her presence?
Very free. Now I'll tell you an example. Now a recent example, which I think is relevant and quite fair to quote. Now the other members of my father's generation. And I'm thinking now of my father himself and my stepmother, of course with no blood relation, and certainly Mrs. Cunningham and Mrs. Harrison Broadley, I won't go beyond those, they held extremely anti-black views. In other words, they resented seeing black men in London. They would like to have completely shut out immigration from the new Commonwealth of coloured men. Coloured people from this Commonwealth.
Mm.
They were also tremendously pro Ian Smith as regards the Rhodesian issue.
Mm.
Now, Aunt Joan, Mrs. Cruikshank, was the direct opposite of that, and so was I myself.
Mm.
I don't want to stress my views, but when I talked to Mrs. Cruikshank about these matters, I did sometimes, it came out between us that she and I disagreed with the other members of the family on this.
So that must have given you quite a bond.
Oh, it did. It gave me quite a bond because she exactly took my view about the rights of black people and about the rights of black people to govern themselves in Africa as against being governed by a white minority.
That was quite progressive for that generation.
Very progressive. Oh, it was. Oh, absolutely. Yes, it was.
What about... sort of energy and so on. Was she always bustling around and sort of busy? Or get impression of a person who was energetic?
Yes, I think so. Mm. Not perhaps quite as much as with Mrs. Duval.
Mm.
But yes, I think so. Yes, she was what you call a bustly person.
Mm.
Yes, I think so.
What about housework and housekeeping? Presumably she wasn't used to doing that.
I don't know if she was I wouldn't say that she was a Mrs. Beaton, if you know what I mean. She wasn't particularly good cook, I don't think.
Mm.
I remember she had one or two servants at the gatehouse before the war, and I think she was probably very nice to them, but I think she was a little bit, as a housewife, if I may say this perhaps in confidence, I would think she was a little bit slapdash, not really interested, as long as the food was reasonably good and as long as the house was reasonably clean. I don't think she was one of these women who were always fussing about the house. You wouldn't call her particularly house proud.
No.
She didn't sort of... I should think
there
she was rather good
things.
From a maid's point of view. She wouldn't be interfering with maids too much, you know. From that point of view, I think she'd be quite nice.
Mm.
But probably anybody like Mrs. Beaton would perhaps think that she wasn't perhaps quite 100% in that way.
That really rather brings me to personal comforts, really. I mean, that generation were curiously austere,
weren't they,
as far as their personal comforts were concerned, and felt rather guilty about spending money on themselves.
Yes, they did. Now, that was very true of my family.
Mm.
It was true of all my family. It was true of my father. I always used to think, why doesn't he spend more money on his own comforts? Why doesn't he get himself nicer clothes? Why doesn't he get himself a nice, comfortable chair? He had the money to do it. There's no question of that.
Mm.
And yet... He did have this, I can speak perhaps more freely about my father, he certainly did have this feeling of, you could almost call it guilt, if he spent much money on himself, he would invariably go to Lyons Corner House when he wanted a meal in London, and he hardly ever took a taxi, But other people who've been related to me on other sides of my family were rather the same. So perhaps it was a thing of that generation rather than a particular family.
And a class thing, in a way.
Definitely. Yes, I think so.
Yeah,
and probably Mrs. Cruikshank was much the same. She always used to stay at the Guide Club when she came to London. And it was a great pleasure to be invited to supper there, to dinner there in the evening. And I used to go several times to the Guide Club, and other times I'd ask her to dine at my club as well. And, you know, it was great fun, that. And that's where I remember her most, meeting her in London like that. And she used to come up for the sort of reunion meetings of Indian civil servants, which usually seemed to take place in October, I think. And that's when she would meet the Pethick Lawrences again, and her old friends, like other people like that.
She was, did she have views on health? I mean, she was presumably a rather healthy person, was she?
I think she probably, if you got onto that subject, she would have had views about diet and health. I think she probably would. I can't remember myself particularly discussing that with her.
I mean, you just took her good health for granted, did you, in a way? I mean, it was just something she didn't talk about, or...
I think so, yes, I think so, yes.
Because they're all a long-lived family, aren't
they? They were a wonderfully long-lived family. They always used to say it was marrying into the Portman family. One of the ancestors married a Portman. And they always used to say that they were the long-lived, that they lived forever. You see, my cousin, the Baronet, lived to be 92. My father lived to be 91. Mrs. Duval lived to be 96. Mrs. Cruikshank must have been about 94, I think. Almora will tell you exactly. And Mrs. Cunningham lived to be about 89. And Mrs. Harrison Broadley, the only one who's still living, must, I think, be just about 90 now, or will be 90 this year.
Good heavens, yes.
She's the only one still living, but she's an invalid now.
I believe she's not in a position to talk to her.
You can't talk to her. She's in an invalid home now, I'm afraid.
Still, that's quite a record. Well, could we move on to Mr. Duval, if you feel that we've
certainly.
Sort of...
Yes, Mrs. Duval, I can't talk to you so much about her. I first remember Mrs. Duval when she lived at Adelphi, you know, they had a
London,
flat.
Yes,
in London, Adelphi. And she was never very, she was always, I think, the poorest member of the family. Because she didn't marry a very well-off man. He was Victor Duval, who was, I never knew what he did. He was a businessman who tried unsuccessfully to become a Liberal Member of Parliament. But he wasn't very successful in life, I don't think. And so they were never terribly well-off, the Duvals. And I remember thinking, because, you know, that I used to go as a child, I was brought up mainly with my mother's side of the family. And because my mother, I say, died when I was only a baby. And for various reasons that don't concern us, I was, in fact, largely brought up as a child by my grandmother on my mother's side, my mother's mother. Well, now, we used to live in Knightsbridge, just near the Hyde Park Hotel. We had a house with a basement and an attic, you know, and about three floors between. It was a Georgian house, but the sort of house nobody could ever possibly live in now because it had a... incredible basement, you know, pitch dark and all this sort of thing. Anyway, I remember going to several children's parties given by Mrs. Duval, and of course her daughters were there, and they had this flat in the Adelphi, which I used to think, as a place to live in, would be very gloomy, because it did seem, it was rather gloomy. It was an old block of flats, I've no idea when it was built, but it was rather dark and gloomy, I think undoubtedly it was. And, but they, what I think one ought to say about it is that they did, you know, make the most of it. They gave very enjoyable parties. I remember they had a certain theatrical talent because one of my cousins, the elder daughter of Mrs. Duval, Diana, who's now Mrs. Ellis, she was quite theatrical. In fact, she acted with the Owls at one time. They went to live at Oxford. The Duvals, you know. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Oh, well, I'll tell you about that in a moment.
Do, yes.
But I do remember that they acted things for us at these children's parties. You know that thing about the king wants some more butter on his bread and that. I forget now, just, it's a well-known thing, isn't
it?
Yes,
I've heard.
And they did perform that, and they had games like Postman's Knock and this sort of thing. And they would ask about 20 or 25 children, I suppose. And it was a regular children's party with nannies in attendance, you could say.
There's that same zest for life, then, is there?
Absolutely,
in that
zest for
too,
life, yeah. Absolutely. Mm. And there it was. Then...
What about Victor, if I could interrupt you?
Well,
did you
I
ever
knew very
him?
Little, yes, but I saw very little of him. Mm. I remember my father, who knew him much better than I did, of course, I remember him once saying about Victor Duval, "Oh, he's a man and he's interested in things that other men are interested in. He plays billiards, he likes talking over a drink, the things that other men like." You know, as if that was something rather special to say about a man, that he liked things that other men liked, as if it was something rather peculiar almost. But still, that's by the way, of course.
But we were on the Duvals, and you said that they lived in the Adelphi. When did they actually move then? You said they moved to Oxford. Was that...
They moved to Oxford. Yes, they did move to Oxford. I think about the late 30s, I would say. They got this old manor house, which was near Abingdon. It was at Sunningdale, near Sunningwell, Sunningwell,
yes.
Near Abingdon. Mm. And it was a really old manor house with beams and plaster. Very old indeed, and it had an orchard and some other fruit trees and that kind of thing. And I used to go and stay with them there sometimes. And
they were there what from
they
when
were
to
there,
when then?
They were there. Well, it's still owned by them. I mean, it's Mrs. Weir's now, Elizabeth, the younger daughter, inherited it, and she lets it. But latterly, I think they only let it out to people. But their reason, I think, for going there was that they wanted to meet undergraduates at Oxford. In fact, Diana did find her first husband was an undergraduate at Oxford, a man called Peter Ord, who she met at Oxford. Mm. He was an undergraduate at Exeter College, Oxford.
That's interesting.
And their marriage, unfortunately, came to an end. But I think they certainly asked a large number of undergraduates to the old manor. And gave a lot of parties there. Mm. But as I was at Cambridge, of course, I didn't go to them. So I could have told you more if I'd been at Oxford, because they were just the right period for me. Mm. In fact, they were there during those years, 1935 to 1939. In fact, Diana was married from the old manor in just after the war had broken out, in the winter of 39, I think it was.
So did they go there really, in a sense, to marry off their daughter?
Well, one can't quite say this, but I always thought that was something to do with it, yes.
It wasn't, there was no income reason for going there. I mean, Victor Duval didn't have a job or anything in that locality.
Nothing like that. Mm. No, I never went there, but they did live in Lancaster at one time.
Did they?
The Duvals, yes, they lived up in Lancaster. I can't tell you just when or how
long.
It would
be very interesting to talk to the daughters, wouldn't it? Because Mrs. Duval, as you say, and Victor were very important people in the movement.
Yes.
I'd like to know more about them. But what was Mrs. Duval like then? I mean, was she like her sister, really, or did she differ?
Well, there was a family resemblance, of course, as there is between all the members of the family, my father and all his sisters. I think their voice and their manner and, to some extent, their appearance, there was a family resemblance. On the other hand, having said that, they all did have their own individual characteristics. And I think that, difficult to describe people, isn't it, but I think, coming to Mrs. Duval, I think probably she was the most intellectual member of the family, really. She liked concerts and music. She'd been head girl at Cheltenham College, I believe. She and I think Mrs. Cruikshank as well had gone to Cheltenham Ladies' College as girls,
Yes, she had.
And probably, you know, if they'd been born of a later generation, they'd have gone on to university, but that didn't happen. But I think she was very musical, Mrs. Duval. She was a singer to some extent. I'm sure she would have played the piano and that kind of thing. And I think she was intellectual, and I think she was always interested in the theatre and that kind of thing.
There is quite a close tie, I think, as a matter of interest, between the arts and the woman suffrage movement.
Is that?
And there's quite
yes.
a lot of interconnections,
oh,
really.
Oh, yes.
So that would be not surprising.
Yes, I didn't know that.
Because the Granville Barkers and Gilbert Murray and Shaw, of course,
yes.
and they're all mixed up in this.
Yes.
Yes. It's really quite a close connection. And, of course, Sybil Thorndike and Lewis Casson and
yes.
prominent actors, you know.
Yes,
like
yes.
What about her two daughters, then? She was presumably ambitious for her daughters to marry, right? As I believe Mrs. Cruikshank was, because Mrs. Murdoch told me that her mother didn't expect her to have a career at all, which
no.
is rather surprising in a way.
Yes,
I mean, you'd think she
it
would.
Is.
But,
yes,
but,
yes, you would have thought so, yes.
I mean, quite conventional, as far as I see it, as you're presenting them and as Mrs. Murdoch presented them, they're really rather conventional in their attitude to what their own daughters should do. Or is that wrong?
Yes, I think they were rather conventional as regards what their own daughters should do. They certainly didn't go out of their way to give their daughters any special educational facilities. They just went to fairly ordinary schools, which almost any parent might have sent their daughters to. I don't think they did really make special provision for them in this way. And as far as I know, none of the daughters have any leanings towards taking part in a suffrage movement or anything similar.
Or no real careers either.
No,
I mean,
none of them have ever had a career. Mrs. Weir serves in an antique shop. She's done that sort of thing for some time, just a matter of interest. Diana, the elder one, who I think did act with the Owds once or twice, she married, you see, when she was still pretty young, 1939. And Almora was, as I say, also married very young. She was in the Land Army, but she had no career, or, as far as I know, any plans for a career.
No. I mean, she now tells me she wishes she'd gone to university, you know, she would have liked to have gone to university. It's rather unusual. You'd think that their mothers would push them, you know, into having careers and going to university and so on. But
I remember once when I was at Cambridge as an undergraduate, I went to Almora was at a school, a place called Buntingford, which isn't very far from Cambridge, and I went over and spent the day with her. I took her out to lunch or something, and that was done, of course, on Mrs. Cruikshank's sponsorship or suggestion. And so that, you see, I think I'm right in saying Mrs. Cruikshank was fond of me. I was her nephew, but I think she was fond of me, you know, beyond just being her nephew. And I, of course, was very fond of her. And Mrs. Duval, I didn't see so much of. Of course, when she went to Oxford, she wasn't in London so much. She never, I don't think, came to London so much. And then, of course, she was rather an invalid for quite a long time before she died. It wasn't really possible to see much of her for the last few years of her life.
Well, she stayed at Sunningwell all that time, did she?
Not all the time. She did come to London, and her daughter, really, Mrs. Weir, the younger daughter, looked after her mother very well, devotedly, I think, and really took all the brunt of it, because, of course, her sister was married and had her own children to bring up. Whereas Mrs. Weir did marry, but her marriage didn't last very long, and she never had any children. And she didn't marry till she was, I can't remember how old she was, but I'm sure she was well over 30.
Well, how does Una differ from Joan?
Well, it's difficult to describe. they were different. I think Una more than Joan had this capacity for forgetting what the time was. Una would talk and talk, and it, you know, lunchtime would go by, and it would actually come to tea time, and she'd still be talking. She had no sense of time if she was interested in something. She was a magnificent talker, tremendous talker. Well, Joan was also a good talker, but I think Una perhaps was even more so. I think that if they both had something of that characteristic, Una had it more pronouncedly than Joan did.
And this was talk about cultural things,
This would be talk about well, almost anything that interested them. It would be talk about political matters.
We're just really talking about Mrs. Duval, really, now, weren't
yes,
we? And how
yes,
she differed from her
exactly,
sister.
Well,
you
I'm trying to tell you how she differed. I think she had even more absorption in what she was talking about, perhaps, even than Mrs. Cruikshank. Mm. She was, in some ways, rather a vague person. And I think if you were judging them as housewives, which is perhaps on a rather mundane level to judge them, I would put Mrs. Cruikshank a little bit above Mrs. Duval.
She sounds a more practical woman.
Yes, Mrs. Duval wasn't really a practical woman.
Mm.
In fact, I seem to remember that she really left all the cooking to her daughters when they grew up, and they were quite practical.
They had to be.
They had to be, yes. No, that's quite true. Yeah. She wasn't a practical person.
Mm.
She was much more given to, well, music and politics and this sort of thing.
Did actually either of them talk a lot about their suffragette days? I mean, was it an important thing that came up in conversation
I can't say that I recall them when I was there talking greatly about it, but that doesn't mean to say they didn't do it.
No, no, but it wasn't in any way an obsession
no,
or
I don't
or
think
a
so,
comment,
no, I don't think so.
No,
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 no.
And presumably Mrs. Duval spent her time really on cultural things, and that's how her time was spent in politics, really.
I think so, yes.
Mm.
I think so. And, of course, private business. I mean,
yes,
you know, she'd
family
have
things.
To let house and that sort of
yes.
thing. Oh, yes, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Yes.
What about Victor? When did he die, then?
Victor, well, you know, I can't tell you quite when Victor did die, but I think it was a good long time ago. I should think it was either during the war or very shortly
yes,
after.
I see.
But there again, you will get that from Mrs. Weir and Mrs. Ennis.
Because he's a very interesting man, actually. And
is he?
I would
yes.
like to find out more about him. So
I wish you could find out about Gordon Munce, because he turns
yes,
up
I
in these photographs.
Come across him.
In the context of the suffragette movement, like in that photograph.
You see, I haven't come across the name at all.
No,
I'm not
no.
sure that there is, he was there because of a suffrage connection, but I'll see if I can
Of course
find
he
out.
May have just been there because he was a personal friend.
Maybe, yes, or he may have just been a house guest or something like
yes,
that. But
that
I don't
is
know.
Possible.
What about class, by the way? I forgot to ask you. I mean, how did they both, or particularly, if you like, Joan Cruikshank, what was their attitude to class? Did they have an attitude particularly?
Well, I would have thought that Joan I would have thought that they had... Well, they were class conscious because they were that generation. I think it's rather difficult to say. I think they had the class consciousness of their generation, you see. I think they had that. But at the same time, you see, they had quite liberal, radical views. And I think that, well, now my father, I take him as a case in point. I mean, he had, you could say, a class-oriented outlook on life. At the same time, I often remember him saying that he thought that hereditary titles were nonsense and that people shouldn't inherit titles that they hadn't deserved and that they inherited titles all ought to be abolished.
Mm.
Well, now, I can quite hear Mrs. Cruikshank expressing views like that.
Mm.
At the same time, it's rather difficult. They were class conscious, of course, but at the same time, they did object, I think, genuinely to some of them what we might call the grosser features of the class system, like perhaps inherited titles might be considered the most ostentatious expression of that class system, you see. And so they objected to that. I don't know if it's something...
So they're really very much middle-class people, so not really rather a little anti-aristocratic, and a little, presumably, they're very conscious they're not working class. I mean, they're...
Well, I would say that, you see, really, they have... They do go back to the aristocracy by ancestry.
Mm.
If you trace that ancestry back, if you look for aristocrats,
really,
you can find aristocrats in their ancestry.
Yes.
Now, you see, the Merivale Dugdales were...
they really are, yes.
Well, they were country gentry, but they became rather rich, and they did sometimes marry into the aristocracy, put it like that.
Mm.
But they were country gentry, you see.
Mm.
And I would have thought that if you described Mrs. Duval and Mrs. Cruikshank as middle class, I think you ought to say that they were very upper middle class.
Yes.
I wouldn't quarrel with the word middle class if you put the word upper in front of it.
Yes.
If you call them upper middle class.
Yeah.
Because to me, upper class is almost identical with the actual titled aristocracy itself, and they weren't that.
Yes.
But I think you could call them upper middle class.
They were in a way on the fringes of aristocracy.
They were on the fringes of it. Oh, definitely. Yes, yes.
That's very fascinating.
But of course, what I do remember is how, when we were going back to Mrs. Cruikshank now more, the interest she took in everything around her, and of course, you see, there were the children of my cousins, Frank and Margaret. There were two boys called Bill and John, Bill being the elder, who's now the baronet, of course. And there were two daughters called Judith and Susan. And there used to be all sorts of children's parties. When I say children's, I really mean teenagers' parties, which were given by various people. In fact, there was a children's dance at Merivale that I went to, a teenager's dance. I went to it myself. The first time I stayed at the Gatehouse, it was at Christmas time. And they did it marvellously well, children's dance, with, of course, some adults there who were related and so on. And other people also gave similar parties. And, of course, Almora met Bill Dugdale, as he was, who was very much of her age. In fact, they were both born in the year 1922. They were exactly the same age, Bill Dugdale and Almora. Mm. And, of course, this is very confidential between you and me. I think, of course, it would have been a wonderful thing in my aunt's view if Almora could have married Bill Dugdale and therefore married the heir to the Merivale property and eventually, of course, although the heir to the baronetcy and so on. Well, the baronetcy is a very new one. It was created in 1936.
Was it really?
Yes.
And this is the Sir Thomas Dugdale.
Sir William Dugdale.
Sir William Dugdale. The Thomas Dugdale is related. Is he the one of the Crishall Down case?